This program is intended for individuals who are blind or are unable to read physical print and is brought to you by CABVI's Audio Information Services team.
Hi, this is Tricia reading the front page of the New York Times for April 29th, 2024. Many Ukrainian prisoners of war show signs of trauma and sexual violence. As they return with physical and psychological wounds stemming from torture by their Russian captors, soldiers are being sent back to active duty, often without adequate treatment. And there's a photograph of a rally with people holding signs that are red and that are blue and yellow, some with photos of soldiers. And the caption says, a demonstration last fall in Kyiv, Ukraine, to draw attention to military service members held by Russia as prisoners of war. By Carlotta Gall and Alexandra Tubko. The Ukrainian Marine infantrymen endured 9 months of physical and psychological torture as a Russian prisoner of war, but was allotted only 3 months of rest and rehabilitation before being ordered back to his unit. The infantryman, who asked to be identified only by his call sign, Smiley, returned to duty willingly, but it was only when he underwent intensive combat training in the weeks after that the depths and range of his injuries, both psychological and physical, began to surface. Quote, I started having flashbacks and nightmares, end quote, he said. Quote, I would only sleep for 2 hours and wake up with my sleeping bag soaking wet, end quote. He was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder and referred for psychological care and is still receiving treatment. Ukraine is just beginning to understand the lasting effects of the traumas its prisoners of war experienced in Russian captivity, but it has been failing to treat them properly and returning them to duty too early, say former prisoners, officials, and psychologists familiar with individual cases. Nearly 3,000 Ukrainian prisoners of war have been released from Russia in prisoner exchanges since the 2022 invasion began. More than 10,000 more remain in Russian custody, some of whom have endured 2 years of conditions that a United Nations expert described as horrific. The Ukrainian government's rehabilitation program, which has usually involved 2 months in a sanitarium and a month at home, is inadequate, critics say, and the traumas suffered by Ukrainian prisoners are growing with the length and severity of the abuse they are being subjected to as the war drags on. And there's a photograph of a soldier sitting in a hallway, and the caption says, a Ukrainian infantryman whose call name is Smiley endured 9 months of physical and psychological torture as a Russian prisoner of war. Russia's torture of prisoners of war has been well documented by the United Nations, with former inmates speaking of relentless beatings, electric shocks, rape, sexual violence, and mock executions. So much so that one expert described it as a systemic, state-endorsed policy. Many detainees have also reported lingering symptoms, like blackouts and fainting spells stemming from repeated blows to the head that were severe enough to cause concussions. Ukraine's Prosecutor General, Andrei Kostin, said in September that, quote, about 90% of Ukrainian prisoners of war have been subjected to torture, rape, threats of sexual violence, or other forms of ill treatment, end quote. The Russian military did not answer a request for comment on the allegations of mistreatment of Ukrainian prisoners of war. Most of the released prisoners have returned to active duty after about 3 months of rest and rehabilitation, as the Ukrainian military, short of troops on the front line, has given relatively few medical exemptions to former prisoners of war. A law passed this month will allow former prisoners of war the choice of returning to service or being discharged from the military, recognition that many have been subjected to severe mental and physical torture and need prolonged rehabilitation. Ukrainian officials acknowledged that there had been problems in providing sufficient care for former prisoners, but said they had now developed special centers for them using best international practices. Ukrainian prosecutors have identified 3,000 former military and civilian prisoners who can serve as witnesses for a case they are building for the Ukrainian courts to charge Russian individuals and officials with mistreatment of prisoners. The prosecutors encouraged two of the former prisoners to speak to the New York Times. And there's a photograph of women sitting around an office table looking at papers. The caption says, "Family members of Ukrainian soldiers who continue to be held by Russia as prisoners of war, meeting with Lyudmila Denisova left, the former human rights ombudsman of Ukraine." One of them was Smiley, 22, who was captured at the beginning of the war when the Russian Navy seized Ukrainian positions on Snake Island in the Black Sea. He spoke a year after his release, saying he hoped that shedding light on the conditions of Russian prisons would help not only his own rehabilitation, but also the thousands of prisoners of war still in captivity. Quote, "My sister persuaded me to give my first interview," end quote, he said. Quote, "You need to tell," she said. "Maybe if we speak, it will help the treatment of our guys," end quote. A second Ukrainian serviceman made available by the prosecutors gave a lengthy interview, but declined to give his name or call sign because of the stigma surrounding the abuses he suffered. The serviceman, 36, said he was taken prisoner along with several thousand soldiers and Marines after a long siege at the Azovstal Iron and Steel Works in Mariupol in May 2022. He spent 9 months in Russian captivity before being released in a prisoner exchange early last year. He spent most of his time in three detention facilities in the Russian towns of Tangarog, Kamchatsky, and Kursk. He returned critically underweight, suffering from an injured spine and, like many others, blackouts, dizziness, and ringing in the ears from frequent beatings on the head. Quote, "I'm not fainting any longer," end quote, the serviceman said. Quote, "But I have difficulties with my back and concussion, and a squeezing all the time in the area around my heart," end quote. Despite his injuries, he was ordered to return to light duty as a guard after only 2 months' rest in a sanitarium. Quote, "I don't know if I could run a kilometer," end quote, he said. And there's a photograph of him showing just his hand resting on a table in part shadow. And the caption says, "A Ukrainian serviceman, 36, who was taken prisoner after a long siege at the Azovstal Iron and Steel Works in Mariupol in May 2022. Prisoners were subjected to brutal daily beatings on their legs, backs, and fingers, and mental and physical torture during interrogations, as well as hunger, cold, and a lack of medical care, he said. Three men died in custody during his imprisonment, including one who died in the communal cell they shared, he said. Some of the Russian units guarding or interrogating the prisoners were worse than others, the two former prisoners said, but there were consistent beatings every morning at roll call and torture at most detention facilities. Interrogations would last 40 minutes and often consisted of electric shocks, blows to the head, and sexual abuse, real or threatened. Quote, "They start with maximum violence," end quote, the serviceman said. Quote, "They say, 'You're lying. You're not telling us everything.' They put a knife to your ear or offer to cut off one of your fingers," end quote. Others would beat them on the back of the head so regularly that they lost consciousness, he said. Quote, "If one gets tired, another takes over," end quote, he recalled. Quote, "When you fall, they make you stand again. It can last 30 to 40 minutes. At the end, they say, 'Why did you not tell us everything immediately?'" end quote. Smiley said much of the violence was of a sexual nature. One prison unit repeatedly struck the prisoners all over their bodies, including on the genitals, with batons that gave electric shocks, he said. On another occasion, he said, a cellmate was repeatedly kicked in the genitals during roll call, where prisoners were lined up with their legs spread, facing a wall in a corridor. Smiley suffered permanent injury from an untreated broken pelvis from a truncheon blow and could not bend or lie down without assistance for 2 weeks. And there's a photograph of a dozen servicemen wearing face masks or bandanas, and a woman in the foreground carrying a sign. And the caption says, "Soldiers from Ukraine's Azov Regiment gathered in central Kyiv this month as their supporters held banners calling for the release of more than 900 of its soldiers held by Russia since the fall of Mariupol in 2022. The International Committee of the Red Cross, which has very limited access to prisoners of war held in Russia, was not permitted to visit him during his 9 months of imprisonment," he added. The second serviceman said he was forced to strip and place his genitals on a stool as his interrogators hit them with a ruler and lay a knife on them, threatening to castrate him. Interrogators put him through a mock execution, firing a volley of gunfire beside him while he was blindfolded. They threatened him with rape, the serviceman said, making him choose what they should use, a mop handle or the leg of a chair. Quote, "Do you want to do it yourself or do you want us to help you?" End quote, they taunted him. He said that he was never actually penetrated, but that others were raped. Quote, "After that, you cannot walk normally," end quote, he said. Quote, "You suffer for weeks. Other guys had the same treatment," end quote. Quote, "I think they had such an order to break us psychologically and physically so that we would not want anything else in life," end quote, he said, adding that there were suicides in the Tangarog jail. Quote, "You could hear the screams all day," end quote, the serviceman said. Quote, "Impossible screams," end quote. Sometimes during a lull, the prisoners could hear the voices of children playing outside, he said. The ordeal for the former prisoners is by no means over once back home. Quote, "The most difficult thing is having too many people around," end quote, the serviceman said. Quote, "Everyone is peacefully walking in the park, and you are still afraid that someone is listening, or that you might get shoved or say the wrong thing," end quote. Major Valeria Sopotina, a military press officer and a former journalist who was also taken prisoner at Azovstal, and who spent a year in women's prisons in Russia, recently opened a meeting space in Kyiv called Ukraine, spelled Y-O-U, for former prisoners. Quote, "There are many triggers, and people do not realize they still need care," end quote, she said. And there's a photograph of her sitting by a window in half shadow, and the caption says, "Major Valeria Sopotina, who spent nearly a year as a prisoner of war in Russia after the siege in Azovstal in Mariupol at the Ukraine hub in Kyiv. She returned to service 3 months after her release last April, but found it hard to sit in an office. Quote, "I cannot bear someone approaching me from behind or standing behind me," end quote, she said. The government psychologists were not of much use, she said. Quote, "They often don't know how to help us," end quote, she said, and civilians often ask careless questions. As a result, many former prisoners find returning to the front line easier than rejoining civilian life, she said. And only fellow survivors really understand what they are going through. Quote, "We don't want to feel pity," end quote, she said, quote, "because we are proud that we survived and we overcame this," end quote. As anger grows over Gaza, Arab leaders crack down on protests. Grief and rage over the war and Israel have led to demonstrations across the Arab world. Arrests suggest governments fear the outrage could boomerang. And there's a photograph of a rally in a square with hundreds of people and two flag banners about three stories tall suspended from the building behind them. The caption says, "A pro-Palestinian demonstration in Cairo in October when Egyptian government was organizing rallies of its own. But even then, some protesters were arrested by Vivian Yee, Vivian Nareem, and Imad McKay." Vivian Yee and Imad McKay reported from Cairo, and Vivian Nareem from Riyadh, Saudi Arabia. Like other governments across the Middle East, Egypt has not been shy about its position on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Its denunciations of Israel over the war in Gaza are loud and constant. State media outlets broadcast images of long lines of aid trucks waiting to cross from Egypt into Gaza, spotlighting Egypt's role as the sole conduit for most of the limited aid entering the besieged territory. Earlier this month, however, when hundreds of people gathered in downtown Cairo to demonstrate in solidarity with Gaza, Egyptian security officers swooped in, arresting 14 protesters, according to their lawyer. Back in October, the government had organized pro-Palestinian rallies of its own. Yet at those, too, it detained dozens of people after protesters chanted slogans critical of the government. More than 50 of them remained behind bars, our lawyers said. It was a pattern that has repeated itself around the region since Israel, responding to an attack by Hamas, began a six-month war against in Gaza. Arab citizens' grief and fury over Gaza's plight running headlong into official repression when that outrage takes aim at their own leaders. In some countries, even public display of pro-Palestinian sentiment is enough to risk arrest. Out of step with their people on matters of economic opportunity and political freedoms, some governments in the Arab world have long faced added discontent over their ties with Israel and its chief backer, the United States. Now the Gaza war, and what many Arabs see as their own government's complicity, has driven an old wedge between rulers and the world with new force. Morocco is prosecuting dozens of people arrested at pro-Palestinian protests or detained for social media posts criticizing the kingdom's rapprochement with Israel. In Saudi Arabia, which is pursuing a normalization deal with Israel, the United Arab Emirates, which has already struck one, the authorities have displayed such hypersensitivity to any hint of oppression that many people are too frightened to speak on the issue. And Jordan's government, caught between its majority Palestinian population and its close cooperation with Israel and the United States, has arrested at least 1,500 people since early October, according to Amnesty International. That includes about 500 in March, when huge protests were held outside the Israeli embassy in Amman. And there's a photograph of one of those protests with thousands of people in the square and a line, several lines of police facing them. The caption says, Jordan arrested about 500 people at a protest near the Israeli embassy in March. Afterward, the president of the Jordanian Senate, Fazail al-Fayyaz, said that his country, quote, will not accept that demonstrations and protests turn into platforms for discord, end quote. Arab autocracies rarely tolerate dissent, but activism around the Palestinian cause is particularly thorny. For decades, Arab activists have linked the struggle for justice for the Palestinians, a cause that unites Arabs of different political persuasions from Marrakesh to Baghdad, to the struggle for greater rights and freedoms at home. For them, Israel was an avatar of the authoritarian and colonialist forces that have thwarted their own society's growth. Quote, what's happening to the Palestinian people clarifies the foundation of the problem for Arabs everywhere, that the problem is tyranny, end quote, said Abdulraham Sultan, a 36-year-old Kuwaiti who has participated in sit-ins in support of the Palestinian cause since the war began. Kuwait initially tolerated some of the sit-ins, but for some Arab governments, the connection evokes peril. Palestinian flags were a common sight at the Arab Spring protests that swept the region in 2011. In Egypt, where, since taking power in 2013, President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has quelled protests and muffled most criticism, the authorities are ever mindful that activism can quickly boomerang against them. And there's a photograph of a group of people at a protest holding signs and big stylized keys. And the caption says, a protest in solidarity with the Palestinian people in Kuwait City. Most Persian Gulf monarchies are far less tolerant of dissent. Quote, today they're out to protest for Palestine. Tomorrow they might protest against himself, the president, end quote, said Nabah Ghanati, 30, a human rights lawyer who represents the 14 activists arrested in April at the April 3rd protest in Cairo. The message, said Mahanur Al-Masibri, a human rights lawyer who joined the demonstration, quote, is that people shouldn't even dream that there exists any margin for freedoms or for democracy, and that you should never gain confidence and then move toward bigger demands, end quote. Ms. Al-Masibri was arrested along with 10 other protesters during a smaller solidarity protest outside United Nations offices in Cairo last Tuesday, according to Ahmad Duma, a well-known Egyptian activist. They were later released. In interviews conducted around Egypt, Morocco, and Persian Gulf countries, including Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, Oman, and Kuwait, many citizens describe the Israeli-Palestinian conflict in stark terms, viewing the Palestinian cause as a struggle for justice, Israel as a symbol of oppression, and, in some cases, their rulers' dealings with Israel as morally bankrupt. Coming after agreements by Bahrain, Morocco, and the United Arab Emirates to normalize ties with Israel, along with Saudi steps toward following suit, the war has galvanized outrage in those countries toward not only Israel, but also Arab leaders willing to work with it. Quote, if you're willing to sell that and sell those people out, sell yourself out, what's next? What else is for sale? End quote, said Salam, an Emirati in his 20s who asked to be identified by a middle name given the Emirati authorities' record of punishing dissent. Governments that signed agreements with Israel have often described the decision as a step toward greater regional dialogue and interfaith tolerance. In February, the Emirati government said in a statement to the New York Times that keeping its diplomatic ties with Israel open was, quote, important in difficult times, end quote. But because of hostility or, at best, indifference toward Israel in the broader Arab public, there is a, quote, direct necessary connection, end quote, between authoritarianism and the signing of such agreements, said Mark Lynch, a political science professor focused on the Middle East at George Washington University. And there's a photograph of a man in a uniform speaking into a megaphone and a group of people around him. The caption says, security forces at a demonstration this month in Amman, Jordan, where at least 1,500 people have been arrested during protests. The fact that some Gulf Arab states have used Israeli surveillance tools to monitor critics only cements that impression. Quote, if people had any space to democratically elect or express, they wouldn't choose to normalize with Israel, end quote, said Miriam Al-Hajari, a Qatari sociologist and anti-normalization activist. Many Arab governments have tried to tame or harness popular anger with heated rhetoric condemning Israel over the war. Yet they too see many practical benefits to ties with Israel to renege on peace deals, analysts say. Egypt, the first Arab country to make peace with Israel, has developed a close security partnership with its neighbors over years of jointly combating militancy in northern Sinai. Egypt and Israel have also worked together to blockade Gaza to contain Hamas, whose brand of militant political Islamism Egypt considers a threat. And Egypt needs Israel's cooperation to prevent a huge influx of Palestinian refugees from Gaza. Gulf monarchies, including Saudi Arabia and the Emirates, which have for years faced attacks by Iran-backed groups, have long maintained back-channel security connections with Israel, which sees Iran as its greatest threat. That enemy of my enemy arrangement paved the way for normalization talks later on, and critiques of those initiatives are rare since many Gulf monarchies effectively ban all forms of protest and political organizing. H. A. Hellyer, a Middle East security expert at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, said governments were, quote, trying to thread a line between that anger, which I think is very genuinely felt across all sectors of Arab societies, and what those states interpret as their national security considerations, end quote. In the past, some of the region's leaders permitted their frustrated populations to blow off steam with pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel activism. But now that the suffering in Gaza implicates Arab governments in the eyes of many of their citizens, the chants tread on sensitive territory. And there's a view of a pair of trucks going down a highway, and behind them is a town. And the caption says, "Trucks carrying humanitarian aid entering Gaza via the Rafah crossing with Egypt in December." Some Egyptians have criticized their government for, among other things, allowing Israel any say over the delivery of desperately needed aid into Gaza through a border crossing in Egypt. And since October, Moroccans have gathered for large, near-daily solidarity demonstrations in about 40 cities that bring together leftists and Islamists, young and old, men and women. Mostly, the authorities have left them alone. But a few protests have been repressed, according to the rights groups and witnesses, and dozens of protesters have been arrested, including a group of 13 in the city of Salah and an activist named Abdul Rahman Zakid, who had criticized Morocco's normalization agreement with Israel on Facebook. Mr. Zakid was sentenced to 5 years in prison this month. Quote, "People are arrested simply for voicing their opinions," end quote, said Saruk Mohammed, a lawyer in the port city of Tangier and a member of an Islamist political organization. "Moroccans will continue to protest," he said, "as long as their government defies popular sentiment to maintain ties with Israel." Representatives for the government of Egypt and Morocco did not respond to requests for comment. For Arabs like Mr. Sultan from Kuwait, the absence of popular support for relations with Israel means any normalization agreements are doomed to fail. Quote, "To make peace, you need regimes and governments that represent their people, that are elected," end quote, he said. And we see a photograph of a long banner flag being held on either side by a large group of people. And the caption says, "A giant Palestinian flag unfurled in Rabat, Morocco, where there have been near daily protests in dozens of cities." Political memo. Trump's trial could bring a rarity. Consequences for his words. The former president has spent decades spewing thousands and thousands of words, sometimes contradicting himself. That tendency is now working against him in his Manhattan criminal case. And there's a photograph of him sitting in a courtroom, and he's gesturing to a big stack of papers. The caption says, "Donald J. Trump's career-long habit of a ready, fire, aim stream of consciousness can now be held against him by prosecutors and a judge while the former president is on trial," by Maggie Haberman and Jonah E. Bromwich. Quote, "So that's not true? That's not true?" end quote. The judge in control of Donald J. Trump's Manhattan criminal trial has just cut off the former president's lawyer, Todd Blanche. Mr. Blanche had been in the midst of defending a social media post in which his client wrote that a statement that had been public for years, quote, "was just found," end quote. Mr. Blanche had already acknowledged during the Tuesday hearing that Mr. Trump's post was false. But the judge, Juan M. Merchan, wasn't satisfied. Quote, "I need to understand," end quote, Justice Merchan said, glaring down at the lawyer from the bench, quote, "what I am dealing with," end quote. The question of what is true, or at least what can be proven, is at the heart of any trial. But this particular defendant, accused by the Manhattan District Attorney's Office of falsifying business records to conceal a sex scandal, has spent 5 decades spewing thousands and thousands of words, sometimes contradicting himself within minutes, sometimes within the same breath, with little concern for the consequences of what he said. Mr. Trump has treated his own words as disposable commodities, intended for single use, and not necessarily indicative of any deeply held beliefs. And his tendency to pile phrases, on top of one another has often worked to his benefit, amusing or engaging his supporters, sometimes spurring threats and even violence, while distracting, enraging, or just plain disorienting his critics and adversaries. If Mr. Blanche seemed unconcerned at the hearing that he was telling a criminal judge that his client had said something false, it may have been simply because the routine has become so familiar. Mr. Trump's career-long habit of a ready, fire, aim stream of consciousness on social media, on television, to newspaper reporters, to rally attendees, can now be held against him by prosecutors and a judge who has genuine power over him. Prosecutors have asked the judge to hold the former president in criminal contempt for violating a gag order that bars him from attacking witnesses, which they argue is necessary given that his previous attacks had, quote, resulted in credible threats of violence, harassment, and intimidation, end quote. Justice Merchant's questioning of the truth of what Mr. Trump wrote on Truth Social was one of several episodes that had brought into stark relief how talking constantly in public, which made Mr. Trump a tabloid fixture and then a reality television star, has been working against him lately. Eventually, the case could threaten not only Mr. Trump's freedom, but also the central tenets of a lifelong ethos ever present in the former president's patter: a convenient disregard for the truth, the blunt denial of anything damaging, and a stubborn insistence that his adversaries are always acting in bad faith. The consequences so far have been minimal. Prosecutors told the judge at the contempt hearing Tuesday that for now they were not seeking jail time for the comments that mostly targeted two key witnesses: Michael D. Cohen, Mr. Trump's former fixer and personal lawyer, and Ms. Daniels, the porn star who claimed to have had an affair with Mr. Trump and whom Mr. Cohen paid $130,000 to keep silent weeks before the 2016 election. Mr. Trump is less moved by threats of being fined. Still, when he faced a similar punishment in a civil fraud trial late last year, he slowed his attacks on a court official after the penalties mounted. Mr. Trump explained his mentality succinctly while running for president in 2016, when the Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell asked him why he responded to every single slight, the candidate replied, quote, "I have to defend myself," end quote. Mr. Trump's words, which helped deliver him to the White House through dozens of rallies and interviews, often worked against him once he was there. In July 2016, his public call to Russia to quote-unquote find Hillary Clinton's deleted emails from her private server just after he officially became the president Republican nominee became a piece of investigation into whether his campaign had conspired with Russians to help elect him. Mr. Trump was also investigated for obstruction of justice as part of the broader Russian interference investigation by the special counsel Robert S. Mueller III. One of those possible acts of obstruction was a series of tweets in April 2018 in which he declared Mr. Cohen, his personal lawyer who was under investigation, would never flip on him. Mr. Cohen eventually did so. He is expected to be a key witness at Mr. Trump's criminal trial, and prosecutors have suggested they may enter those tweets into evidence. As a sitting president, Mr. Trump was shielded from prosecution. He faced only a hefty report by Mr. Mueller. Those protections fell away when he lost the presidency and left the White House. But Mr. Trump has not changed his approach to public life and appears quite unlikely to ever do so. Mr. Trump has long conflated legal problems with public relations problems, treating the legal kind as easily spun away with statements or deflection. Since the charges were unveiled in April 2023 by the District Attorney Alvin L. Bragg, Mr. Trump and his advisors have braided together legal and political responses. They successfully called on Republicans to defend the former president and baselessly maintained that Mr. Bragg, a Democrat in an overwhelmingly Democratic county, was acting on orders from Mr. Trump's political opponent, President Biden. They have also tried to use political arguments to justify Mr. Trump's actions in the case. During the gag order hearing on Tuesday, Mr. Blanche sought to excuse a collection of Mr. Trump's verbal assaults on Mr. Cohen and Ms. Daniels. He argued that, in attacking them, the former president had been responding to political attacks by his adversaries, who just happened to be witnesses in the case. The judge wasn't buying it. He told Mr. Blanche that he was planning to ask in every example, quote, "What precisely is it that your client is responding to?" end quote. When Mr. Blanche did not have the requested information at hand, Justice Merchan reminded him of the purpose of the hearing. Quote, "I am going to decide whether your client is in contempt or not," end quote, he said, adding, quote, "I keep asking you over and over again for a specific example, and I'm not getting an answer," end quote. Justice Merchan has yet to issue a ruling on whether to find Mr. Trump in contempt. While prosecutors have argued that Mr. Trump is quote-unquote angling to be arrested, some people close to Mr. Trump insist privately that, for all his bravado, he desperately wants to avoid jail. Nonetheless, Mr. Trump has continued apace with comments that test the limits of what he can say. 2 days after the hearing, prosecutors offered 4 new instances in which they said he had violated the gag order. 2 were during political interviews. 1 was in the hallway, right outside Justice Merchant's courtroom, where cameras are stationed to capture Mr. Trump speaking before and after court sessions. There, Mr. Trump hammered at Mr. Cohen's credibility once again. In response, Justice Merchant set a new hearing for this week in which, once again, the former president's statements will be in the spotlight, dissected, considered, and ultimately judged. How fentanyl laid waste to Guatemala's time-worn opium trade. Reshaping the drug war in one of Central America's most lawless corners, the fentanyl boom has devastated the trade in opium poppies used to make heroin. And there's a photograph of soldiers in a poppy patch. And the caption says, "Guatemalan security forces during a mission to eradicate opium poppies last month in Vista Quetzal village, Tahumulco, San Marcos," by Simone Romero, photographs by Daniel Volpe. Simone Romero and Daniel Volpe embedded with Guatemalan forces on an eradication mission in remote mountain villages. The convoy rolled out of the military base before dawn into the mist-shrouded mountains straddling Guatemala's border with Mexico. Its mission: destroy opium poppies used to make heroin. Armed with rifles and machetes, the caravan's nearly 300 soldiers and police officers from elite counter-narcotics units scaled steep hillsides and waded through bone-chilling streams. They chased leads from drone pilots and inhaled dust as they rode in the back of pickup trucks, barreling down washboard dirt roads. But after scouring village after village, they found only tiny plots of poppies here and there, a fraction of the region's cultivation in previous years. Quote, "The land here used to be covered in poppies," end quote, said Ludwin Lopez, a police commander, as soldiers fanned out around Ichikugan, an area of remote hamlets populated by speakers of Mam, a Mayan language. But that was before opium prices plunged from $64 an ounce to about $9.60 an ounce, he added. The largely fruitless search for opium poppies in Guatemala over several days in March laid bare a seismic shift in Latin America's drug trade. In the United States, the world's largest market for illicit drugs, fentanyl has largely displaced heroin because of how cheaply and easily Mexican cartels can produce the synthetic opioid in makeshift labs, using chemicals from China. Fentanyl is so potent that it can be smuggled in small quantities hidden in vehicles, another advantage over heroin. And there's another photograph of the poppy patch with mountains in the background. The caption says, "Guatemalan poppy farmers are losing their primary income from what had been their only cash crop," forcing many in already poverty-stricken areas to migrate to the United States. As a result, demand for opium poppies has plunged. In Guatemala, poppy farmers are losing their primary income from what had been their only cash crop, forcing many in already poverty-stricken areas to migrate to the United States. At the same time, local and international authorities fear that Guatemala could emerge as a new hub for trading in the chemicals used to make fentanyl. Drug busts along the United States-Mexico border also showcase heroin's decline. In the 2023 fiscal year, U.S. Customs and Border Protection's Office of Field Operations seized 1,500 pounds of heroin, down from 5,400 pounds in 2021. Seizures of fentanyl in the same period more than doubled to 27,000 pounds, up from about 11,000 pounds. Even as fentanyl lays waste to the heroin trade and counter-narcotics priorities shift, American authorities say the U.S. support for poppy eradication efforts, though limited, is still needed in Guatemala to counter the reach of Mexican cartels that produce heroin. Still, the highest priority in Guatemala now is combating synthetic drugs and the detection of precursor chemicals used to make fentanyl, said a State Department official who was not authorized to be identified discussing drug interdiction strategies. But the soldiers stomping through small vegetable gardens in remote villages were after opium poppies. Finding a few poppies in patches no bigger than a hopscotch area, they went to work with machetes chopping the plants. They did the same to the occasional cannabis plant, which remains illegal to grow in Guatemala. And there's a picture of the soldiers chopping down the poppy plants. The caption says, in remote villages, soldiers found a few poppies and then hacked at them with machetes. Multiple signs of United States support for the mission and for Guatemala's counter-narcotics efforts in general were on display. Some police officers on the mission belonged to units supported by the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration and undergo regular polygraph and drug testing. Soldiers traveled in four-wheel drive vehicles donated by the United States. The State Department declined to provide a detailed breakdown of U.S. counter-narcotics funding. But altogether, the country has recently received about $10 million to $20 million a year in military and police aid for the United States, according to Adam Isaacson, the Director of Defense Oversight at the Washington Office on Latin America, a research group. That is roughly the same amount of such aid as a decade ago. Overall, Guatemala ranks among the largest recipients of United States foreign assistance in Latin America. An observer from the State Department, which has funded everything in Guatemala from training border police to an elite anti-gang unit, also accompanied the mission. He declined to comment, saying he wasn't authorized to speak with journalists. Since the soldiers' efforts were mostly fruitless, they spent some of their time cracking jokes while mingling around their pickup trucks. Trying to spread goodwill, some distributed items from their food packets to villagers. Others gave away cheap plastic toys to children. Still, in an exceptionally poor region, where each mature opium poppy plant is worth about 25 quetzals, about $3.20, some villagers clearly seethed at the soldiers' presence. Some refused to talk to anyone in the convoy, which they viewed as removing one of their only sources of income. Quote, "We hardly have any poppies left around here anymore," end quote, said Ana Leticia Morales, 26, a mom-speaking mother of two, who makes a living selling gasoline smuggled from Mexico. Quote, "But the soldiers still come, not to help us, but to make things worse." And there's a photograph of some soldiers talking to a line of young children walking in front of them. And the caption says, "Local children greeting security forces who arrived in Los Mochinas village to find and eradicate poppy fields." Tensions around eradication efforts have flared for decades in Guatemala, Central America's most populous country. Opium poppies, which were traditionally grown in mountainous regions stretching from Turkey to Pakistan, began appearing decades ago in Guatemala, as well as in parts of Mexico and Colombia. Mexican cartels relied on Guatemalan farmers to grow the poppies and then turn them into opium gum. Smuggled across the border into Mexico, the cartels would transform the gum into heroin. The United States initially responded by spraying herbicides from planes in Guatemala, but suspended those efforts after flight crews came under concentrated gunfire. This opened the way for the ground operations practiced today. Fentanyl's emergence over the last decade as a cheaper and much more profitable source of income for the cartels upended the poppy trade in Mexico while producing spillover effects in Central America. Now the cartels don't need to worry about heavy rains, which can destroy harvests. They also don't need to worry about eradication operations. Eradicators in Guatemala destroyed about 2,011 acres of opium poppies in 2017, compared with just 7 acres in 2023, Guatemalan government figures show. The decline speaks to the ease in Mexico of using chemicals imported from China to produce fentanyl in small labs about the size of a studio apartment, making it ideal for being manufactured in urban settings. Quote, it's easier to produce a synthetic opioid in a laboratory than relying on a crop grown in remote mountains, end quote, said Rigoberto Camay, an anthropologist from the poppy-growing region of Guatemala. Quote, the authorities are attacking the weakest link in the production chain, end quote, he added, referring to eradication efforts. Quote, but instead of disappearing, drug trafficking is still growing exponentially, end quote. Guatemala, in fact, remains a crucial smuggling nexus for yet another illicit drug, cocaine. The country is also emerging as a place where cocoa, the plant used to make cocaine, is grown. And there's another photograph of soldiers in poppy fields with mountains behind them. The caption says, Guatemalan security forces patrolling the mountains to find and eradicate poppy plants. Counter-narcotics officials in Guatemala, Mexico, and the United States worry that Sinaloa and Jalisco New Generation, the two Mexican cartels vying for control of the routes already used from smuggling cocaine and opium gum from Guatemala, could use those same passages for transporting fentanyl chemical precursors into Mexico. The Guatemalan authorities last year arrested Ana Gabriela Rubio Zia, an entrepreneur known for flaunting her wealth on social media in connection to a scheme to import chemicals from China to manufacture fentanyl for Mexico's Sinaloa cartel. Ms. Rubio Zia, who ran an upscale clothing boutique in the elite stronghold of Calleja in Guatemala City, was extradited to the United States last July to face fentanyl distribution and money laundering charges that could result in life in prison. The Mexican authorities followed that move with an arrest in January of Jason Antonio Yang Lopez, a Guatemalan businessman subjected to sanctions by the U.S. Treasury for importing fentanyl precursor chemicals. Guatemala's new president, Bernardo Arevalo, is strengthening ties with the United States in a bid to respond to the fentanyl trade. In a ceremony in March attended by American officials, his government said it was trying to improve ways to combat the trade in precursor chemicals in Guatemala. But such efforts mean little for villagers confronting fading demand for poppies on the one hand and eradication programs on the other. Reginald Garcia, a MOM leader from the San Antonio Ixcuan, said poppy prices began tumbling in 2017, eventually crashing to 2,000 quetzals, $256 per pound per kilo, from 18,000 quetzals, $2,310. Quote, poppies used to help a lot of people make ends meet, end quote, Mr. Garcia said. Now, he said, the steep decline in poppy prices inflicted so much economic pain that, quote, before the money runs out, people depart for the United States, end quote. And there's a photograph showing the forces crossing a river and emerging on the other side. And the caption said, Guatemalan security forces during an initiation for cadets who plunged into a river to mark their first patrol. News analysis. The offense that Harvey Weinstein can never be convicted of. The movie producer won his appeal in New York on Thursday. But his story, at its core, is about work, and it can't be measured by a criminal court. And there's a photograph of him on the sidewalk using a walker with his lawyers around him and security and photographers. The caption says, Harvey Weinstein arriving at Manhattan Criminal Court for his trial in 2020, by Jody Cantor. Jody Cantor has been reporting on Harvey Weinstein since 2017, when she and Megan Twohey revealed decades of abuse allegations against him. For the first time in years, there is a chance that Harvey Weinstein could walk free. His New York conviction for sex crimes was overturned on Thursday. Manhattan's district attorney says he wants to retry Mr. Weinstein, but that seems, at most, a maybe. The former film producer still has a long sentence to serve in Los Angeles, though next month he is expected to appeal that conviction on grounds similar to those that were successful in New York. His lawyer is the same one who got Bill Cosby's conviction tossed out. Many of Mr. Weinstein's accusers say they are horrified. Even some of the seven judges who participated in the decision were outraged, the majority ruling that his trial was unfair because it introduced witnesses separate from the central charges, prevailed by a single vote, 4-3. The dissenting judges described that decision as quote-unquote oblivious, quote-unquote naive, and, quote, endangering decades of progress, end quote. They have joined a roiling debate about what the standard of evidence in sex crimes trials should be. But criminal convictions have never seemed like the ultimate measure of Mr. Weinstein's behavior. Whether he remains a felon or not, he can never be tried for the most overarching offense he is accused of. That is because, at its core, the Weinstein story, along with its greatest impact, is all about work. Quote, a lot of these stories are about what's been lost career-wise, and there's no criminal remedy that is going to get at that, end quote, Deborah Turkheimer, a law professor at Northwestern, said in an interview. Back when Mr. Weinstein was at the height of his power, he had many gifts as a producer, but where he stood above others was in his ability to make careers. He hired and molded Matt Damon, Michelle Williams, Jennifer Lawrence, Quentin Tarantino, and some of the most successful producers working today. He invented the Oscar campaign as we know it. At those awards, he was thanked more often than God. Behind the scenes, he was summoning that career-shaping power in the darkest way, according to his accusers. The nearly 100 allegations about Mr. Weinstein range in severity from harassment to rape, but almost all those stories follow the same plot. Whether they were actresses or assistants, the women were mostly young, some in their first month or even day on the job. Laura Madden was a novice assistant on Irish movie sets. Rowena Chu had directed plays at Oxford University. They and many others wanted to work to contribute, to secure a piece of the action in a mostly male-run business. And there's a photograph of a woman sitting on steps. And the caption says, Catherine Kendall is one of the many women who have accused Mr. Weinstein of sexual misconduct. Mr. Weinstein is accused of luring them and many others with a standard script that promised a career payoff. Come to my hotel room to talk about how we can throw you an Oscar campaign, Judith Goodrich said he told her. Join me to review this newly shot footage, Sophie Dix recalled him saying. When Don Dunning arrived in his hotel room for what was billed as a work meeting, she said, he offered her contracts for his next three films on the condition that she have a threesome with him. Mr. Weinstein has denied all allegations of non-consensual sex. Quote, welcome to the Miramax family, end quote, Catherine Kendall said he told her in 1993. Soon, He was nude, and she was fleeing, she said. Quote, he said the things that make you think that's going to happen for you, end quote, Ms. Kendall recalled in a recent interview. Quote, he didn't hint. He came right out and said it. He's Harvey Weinstein, and he's directly handing you the key. Or so you think, end quote. Over the years, he appears to have honed the pressure even further, deploying one woman's name to push the next. Though Gwyneth Paltrow spurned his advances, some women say he goaded them by claiming that she and other stars had said yes, that they had only won their roles and Oscars by sleeping with him. By their description, it was a system of turning women's aspirations and achievements against them. Work was also the reason many stayed silent for years. They feared that speaking out would mean ruin. Years later, many Weinstein accusers have told of the pain they experienced over physical violations, but they have also aired grief over career losses. Many of the women are middle-aged now. They point out that there are no do-overs in their work lives, that without Mr. Weinstein, they might have achieved more, that they can never get those years and possibilities back. Caitlin Dulaney, a 60-year-old actor, said in an interview that her memories of her encounter with Mr. Weinstein, he offered her career help and shocked her by taking his clothes off, she has said, are, quote, 100% mixed up in the loss that I feel career-wise, end quote. This is the part of the Weinstein story that no criminal court is likely to come close to addressing. Sexual harassment is illegal, but it's not a criminal offense, and the laws and system that combat it are generally weak. The criminal justice system isn't built to remedy the destruction of someone's career options or ambitions. Women had pursued civil suits against the producer, but many were bundled into one big case that left them waiting in line with other parties owed money by the Weinstein Company. Compared with the payouts for, say, Jeffrey Epstein's victims, the remuneration has been spotty. But while the centrality of work to the Weinstein story has made accountability difficult, it has also endowed the saga with some of its special moral force and helped cohere a powerful new consensus on workplace standards. And that's all the time we have. This has been Tricia reading the front page of the New York Times for April 29th, 2024.